people of Earth. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And we have a terrific guest for you today, the one and only, the great and spectacular Max Blagg. Max is an Englishman who has been living on the Lower East Side since the 1970s. And his work has been published everywhere from Bomb Magazine, The Village Voice, The New York Times. He was co-editor of Bald Ego Magazine for a while with the late, great Glenn O'Brien of TV Party fame. He is a class act, and we talked about all sorts of things. We got a little jacked up from drinking some very strong Irish breakfast tea. You can hear our cups clinking throughout this interview. Excuse me, I was not able to edit out his occasionally yipping dog, but that just adds a flavor, an ambiance to the conversation, if you will. We spoke about how he got to the United States, how he got involved in the Lower East Side poetry scene, and we discussed his infamous Gap ad, for which he received lots of money and lots of scorn back at the time, but mostly that was due to jealousy. And then we also talked about, the changing landscape of New York City, the retail apocalypse that's going on there now, which is kind of fascinating. Lots and lots of boarded up buildings. This recording is a little unusual because I did it face to face, and so wasn't able to edit it as much as I might have wanted to, as much as Max might have wanted me to. Sorry, Max. I did my best. So the talk of LSD and other illicit substances is purely hypothetical. Any resemblance to any person's living or dead is purely coincidental. And at about the 49-minute mark, Max reads an excerpt from his latest chapbook called Walkabout NYC. It is fantastic. Make sure you listen to that. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with the great Max Blagg.
So what kind of tea is this that we're drinking?
This is Irish breakfast tea.
The good stuff.
Very nice. Good stuff.
You can stand your spoon up in it.
Where do you get it from?
I got it, actually, there's a great little cheap store, one of the last ones on Chambers Street, that has a bunch of stuff, you know, but they sometimes have, they had that the last time, they had like boxes of Barry's tea, so I get it there. I don't know, get it wherever, like a Puerto Rico one, on Bleecker, but you know, you probably noticed, you've been walking around, the shrinkage of retail
in New York. Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm
staying in Park Slope, and so the last time I saw a difference from a year and a half ago, there's like just walking down 7th Avenue, that big strip on 7th Avenue, and there's like, oh look, that place is out of business.
So it's the same in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
No, it's everywhere. I mean, these storefronts, you know, even when the businesses are doing reasonably well, that when the lease is up, the landlord is jacking the rent so much that they're just like walk away. They can't do it. Yeah. Even over here, there's a supermarket down on Greenwich Street, which was actually a reasonable alternative to Whole Foods, which is further down. And it was doing okay. And then I went over and it was like, it's closed. It's like, what happened? The lease came up. Yeah. Vornado, who owned a lot of real estate around here, you know, tripled the rent to like, you know, $75,000 or something, in whatever it was. And, you know, the guy just said, no, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. So commercial leases run like, what, 10, 15, 20 years? And, and when it's up, you're done, basically.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like.
I guess. No, but just the squeeze seems on here because, you know, so the other thing is so many people moving into the city. If you know, the other thing you probably know is like, well, if you walk on the Bower, it's like, well, the Bower is really crowded with well-heeled young kids, you know.
I
don't know. I mean, you know, one thing I realize that I don't want to sink into is that sort of bitter nostalgia, you know.
I know. It's just like,
You know, 30 years ago, you could get a loft for $100 a month and blah, blah, blah. You know.
Yeah.
That was then. This
is
now.
This is
the only. But the thing is, the now, it's like The only buildings they seem to be building are luxury buildings. Like these, right. These guys behind me, there's a swimming pool on the roof. This was just built like a couple of years ago. This one that takes up the whole block. And then that place there, out the window, you can see it's like five floors and there's another section. That's like a one family mm-hmm. thing. So it's just like, but they're all like super,
right,
super luxe dormant buildings. But most of the buildings, most of the apartments in this building are not even occupied. Mm. So it's like, it's just an investment,
right,
you know.
Right, for Russian oligarchs or whatever. Yeah. I remember thinking that like 20 years ago. It's like, well, you know, I bet like at some point, if it keeps going like this, there's not going to be any quote unquote bad neighborhoods in Manhattan.
No,
it wasn't that long ago where there were, you know, dodgy.
I mean, look at the Lower East Side now from when you knew it. You know, it's hotels and which, but, you know, I mean, it's nice to be kind of safe, but
you know, the kids don't care. They just move to Bushwick or whatever. Or, you know, so it's just
now it's like out to Astoria
or wherever, or Hempstead, Long Island, or something. But no, I know the whole nostalgia thing is just like, I get it. New York is changing, and it's changing in a lot of ways that I don't like. But at the same time, it's like you can just go like, you know, the city's not been the same since the Copa closed. You know,
yeah, you couldn't people go back like that. I wonder if people complain that if it changed that much though. I think the change is just much more radical than it was. It used to be at least a little more gradual, you know, but now it's like...
It's fast. Yeah, it's
where
true.
The High Line is, there's all these fancy architect-designed skyscrapers, but they're all right next to each other, so they kind of cancel each other. Yeah. Like, look, there's the Woolworth Building, one of my favorite buildings, and then this asshole building right next to it that actually blocks it.
That's ugly.
Blocks its sunlight. Anyway, that's my...
I moved to the city in 1984. And I remember my parents and my aunts and uncle were like, oh, you're moving to Manhattan. It's such a shame what happened to Manhattan. It's such a dump now. It used to be so great. Now it's like dirty and dangerous and you can't ride the subway. And I was like, oh, I think it's great.
Right.
So, right. You know, it's all just your perspective. When did you move to New York?
I arrived here in 1971, mm-hmm. in October. And I had one address, because for some reason I lost my address book right before I left. I was living in London. I lost the address book, which had a few American contacts in it, because I just was going to come over for a look around and whatever. I had one... contact, and so I took a cab from the airport, and I'm looking out the window like, oh my God, and I said to the driver, is that the Empire State Building? He's like,
you want to buy it?
Right, exactly, like that Sylvia Miles thing, right? When the guy asked a Midnight Cowboy, do you remember that scene where was it John Voight? Who turned into a Republican asshole, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
In Midnight Cowboy, though, he said, excuse me, you know where the, he was looking for something, and she's walking a little poodle or something. She said, hey, it's around, you know, it's right around the corner, taking a leak with the Empire State Building or something. Yeah. It was just some great New York put away, you know, it's really, really good.
And so what happened? You ended up...
I was there, and... I hardly knew these people, but they took me in, this couple. We're still friends, although they've moved to Arizona now. They retired, but they took me in. And a week later, I had a job with this guy's construction crew on 53rd Street. Mm-hmm. We were renovating the Museum of Crafts, which was there at the time. I don't know if it's even still there, but it was like 53rd Street, and you know, one of the things. Just before I came over, I'd been reading all these New York poets, like, you know, Berrigan and Frank mm-hmm. O'Hara, Frank O'Hara especially. Mm-hmm. So I was suddenly on 53rd Street. Moondog was still on the corner of 6th Avenue. So it was like this amazing stuff. It was like all this stuff that you'd read about was actually alive and well, you know. And mm-hmm. the same with the poetry scene. It was like you could see a lot of these guys reading at St. Mark's and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas in England, in London at that time, the poetry scene was like, I don't know, seemed like there were a couple of readings a year at the Poetry Society or something. There were always these very, It seemed, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was like that. I mean, there were people like Lee Harwood and Bill Bottler in Brighton and stuff, people like that doing stuff, but it was very, I don't know, I found it really blank and dead. And I tell you, when I came to New York, I felt like I'd been reborn almost, you know. It was like I really found, after 5 days here, I was like, I'm staying here, you know, this place is sort of embracing me, or I'm embracing this place, so. And I did, I, you know, I had a one-way ticket anyway, so I couldn't afford a round trip.
And so you just
I just stayed. I stayed with them for 3 months. And then I hitchhiked to San Francisco because I figured, well, you know, you got to do the on-the-road thing. That was really the most terrifying fucking road trip I ever took. It was around, you know, it was 71, late 71. It was around the time that a lot of the bad acid stuff, and it was after the Manson stuff, but it was pretty creepy crawly. A lot of vets come back from Vietnam and messed up, you know, so it was pretty strange. But anyway, so I went out there, and I lived in San Francisco for like, I don't know, 5 months. But I really missed New York, so I wanted to get back here, you know. So I put a notice up in Berkeley, and is this messing up your...
A little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Hey. Sorry. It's okay. It's because of the food, you know.
Do you mind if I...
No, go ahead.
Yeah.
Let me... Do you mind... Are you going to have the...
Have
a little
good.
Later.
I probably... Yeah. Better for me not to...
Are you still on that diet I read about somewhere?
Yeah, sort of, you know. I'm just...
That's good.
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep the carbs low, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean... Yeah. I bike around all the time, so that's really my main attempt to...
Anyway, so I came back to New York. I actually came back with this girl who was an actress who was heading back to New York to be in Jesus Christ Superstar. So that was kind of a wild trip back, which I made into a piece called 5 Days, which ended up being like a nice little chamber piece, you know.
So were you driving out there, or did you hitchhike, or?
Oh, well, I started hitchhiking, but I kind of gave up. No, I didn't start hitchhiking. I was going to hitchhike, and then I decided to take a Greyhound. I ended up taking a Greyhound to, like, somewhere in Colorado, and I hitchhiked from Colorado to L.A. But it was really...
Not good,
you know, and I had long hair, too, so...
There's a point in the 70s where there was, like... certain element figured out, hey,
yeah,
I can pick up people hitchhiking.
I know. I'm sorry about these dogs. It's just a pain.
Yeah. The last time I hitchhiked was in 1982. I picked up a hitchhiker, and he pulled a knife on me.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, where are you going? He said, well, I'm going to that next town over here. I said, okay, well, I can take you as far as here, and I'll drop. He said, no, you're taking me all the way there. He held out a knife. I was like, okay. And
hey,
luckily,
you're not
he just
to be
got
the,
out
supposed
said,
to be
thanks
the guy
for the ride,
that.
Man.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know.
I didn't ask him for gas money or anything. You
know? No, it's funny. I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I did, when I was coming back, I did... set out hitchhiking, and I got to Mountain View, California, and I was just like, can't do this. Yeah. And I remember some kids saying, hey, watch out for the faggots, man.
Yeah. You know, like, oh. It was the serial killers.
Yeah, exactly. Know. But I mean, they were around, and I mean, I'm sure they still are.
What was that guy's name? There was Randy something, who was called the Highway Killer. And this guy, and it's a crazy story, and he just, like, for 10 years, he just, like, picked up hitchhikers and murdered them. And there was a different time where you could just get away with it. There were no people
right.
who had
there
cell
wasn't
phones
any of the...
or security cameras, and he would go to gay bars and just pick people up, and they'd never be seen again, you know? And so,
no, there's so much more that stuff went on that you even even hear about, right? Because it's just like the
and they caught this guy by accident, you know.
Too, yeah. You know. Well, the same way they caught... Remember, just recently, there was this guy in California. They found from that Ancestry DNA
thing. Oh, really?
And he was like an ex-cop. It turned out He lived in the town, he'd been terrorizing these two towns there for years. It was really a hideous story because he would go to town meetings of concerned citizens saying, we've got to catch this guy and stuff. And then he would like, you know, if there was some guy saying, yeah, I'd like to kill this guy, he would like then go, you know, invade their home kind of thing.
Wow.
He would make the guy lie there. He put, this is a weird little detail, he put plates on the guy's back while he lay down and, you know, sexually assaulted the wife. And of course, if the guy moved, the plates would drop and they would, I don't know.
It was just like, but
you read about it and it's
like,
this happened in a small town over like a long period of time and they never found the guy. And they, you know, now he's like 80 or something and, you know, they've caught him through this DNA stuff, but just by pure, pure luck. It's
so
weird.
there's a note to all listeners, if you are secretly a serial killer for years, don't do 23andMe. Just
turn yourself in now. it's a strange country out there. I feel much safer in New York than anywhere else. That's what I was saying. When I came back, I shared a ride with this, back then they had this... you could like deliver cars across country, you know, pretty new cars. So I shared a ride with this actress who was black and we had this huge Ford. I don't know the make, but it was really big. And we drove back in that. And for some reason, I had no sense then of like, oh, I'm a long-haired white guy, she's black, we could have a problem out in the, you know. And
sure
I never thought about it for some reason. And we didn't, thank God, we didn't have any real problems except a certain hostility, you know, like in the morning in a diner in Ohio or something. But when I think back now, I think like, holy shit, you know, I wouldn't do that now.
Yeah.
For sure, if I was that age, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd still run into problems. I mean, I ran into problems having long hair in the 90s and places like Boston.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I know. It's out there.
Yeah. I was at a bar in Boston in the 90s and I had hair down to here or whatever. And like some guy just like comes up to me and says, what, you know, it's like, who the fuck are you like doing here? And I was like, what is this, like Easy Rider? What is
it? Right. Like, it is though. You
know? So what'd you do when you got back to New York?
Back to New York, she had a loft on 10th Street between C and D, which I also didn't realize how dangerous it was, you know. And so then she started, she went up to the theater every night to be in Jesus Christ Superstar. And I was just sort of looking around for work, you know, in New York and like, you know, giving blood, selling blood for $6 a pint or something. I don't know, really scratching it, you know. And then I started, got jobs in bars and stuff as a busboy and then as a waiter and stuff like that. But I remember the thing was, coming back to New York was really like coming back home. It didn't feel like, oh, I'm in New York, then I'm going to go back to England. That was just off the chart, you know.
And so you just overstayed your visa, or
yeah, I just
okay
I overstayed it by
this?
4 years.
Is ICE gonna come get you?
No, they can't. I'm a citizen now. I just stayed and I left and you know and then came back and got another business visa and got married and got a green card and stuff.
It used to be a lot easier for sure.
Yeah. Even that was easier. Although it was funny because my marriage was perfectly legit, but when I went for the interview, first of all, I didn't get a lawyer because I said, well, you know, we married and we lived together and that should be fine. But I didn't realize that you really should have a fucking lawyer what's the language thing on here, by the way, the curse word thing? Does that apply on the...
Oh, yeah, you can curse.
Oh, not that not
fucking A, yeah.
Not that I want to. But anyway... So the first, then I was waiting and waiting for my green card. I said, why isn't it coming? And finally I got a lawyer to go figure it out. And he said, oh, we've been investigating you for the past year for something.
Wow.
And they even had people follow me. He showed me one surveillance photo he had of me, but I never found out why.
Yeah.
And I wasn't doing anything, so...
Probably just randomly picked somebody's job to investigate. I guess we'll get this guy.
We're tailing somebody today, you know. I don't know.
They didn't... Did they give you the grilling when they ask you, like what color underwear do
well,
you
they did, no, but they said... And we had a dog at the time, a Saluki. They said, well, what color's the dog? What color is the dog you have? And I was like, well, it's kind of... It was a sort of a brindle color, a bit... almost the same calling as this dog that's making all the noise. But I was too casual about, I didn't realize it. They want like real cocky cutter answers.
Right.
You know, you don't want to, what did you have for dinner last night? I said, well, I don't know. I just told them what happened. And basically what happened was I went around the corner to the little Chinese restaurant that was there at the time and had something. And my wife, I don't know, she did something else. I didn't, you know, wasn't kind of, instead of like, if you had a lawyer, they would have said, first you do this, then you remember what both of you had to eat, and you know, so that if you're not legit, you can give them, they just want the right answers. So anyway, I didn't know I'd fail my test by being too honest, you know. So I stayed in New York, and I just started working in bars and stuff and made my money like that, you mm-hmm. know, started doing readings and trying to, I don't know.
Were you writing when you were in England? You grew up in England, obviously.
Yeah. I was writing from a very early age in England. I still have some of the little notebooks from school, actually. I had these little spiral notebooks, you know, in the class. I would just be doing these sort of stream of consciousness, I don't know what they were, kind of things from when I was about 15 or so. So I always wanted to write, but I don't know what the focus was, you know, mm-hmm, was sort of, mm-hmm. then listening to Dylan, I was totally kind of influenced by that, but in a, just for the, you know, the desire to sort of express myself in some kind of poetic way. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So are you on the thumbs up side for Dylan getting the Nobel Prize?
Yeah, totally. I told you I meet with my friend Mike DiCapiti mm-hmm. once a week. We had this little book club meet 8 o'clock in the morning. Because he works downtown, so he passes by. We were talking on last week about various things, you know, but one of them was somehow the subject got on to Dylan and just how his lyrics, you know, how he's the, like Mike said, he's the only guy that could get away with saying, you know, saying something that the guy rode in on a milk white steed. Mm-hmm. And not, it doesn't sound stupid and sentimental somehow. Uh-huh. He somehow overrides the actual content to, I don't know how to explain, because I'm not Christopher Hicks who could, you know, wrote a lot of books about it. I mean, a lot of people have written about it. Anyway, no, we both, the thing is we both really like him, but I don't know, he's really held up because I saw some old interview with him the other day where I just happened to come across it somehow. And in it, he was saying, the interviewer was asking him, said, well, you know, a song like It's All Right, Ma, how did you come to write that? And he's like, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I saw that interview.
I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen again.
Right,
but
right. He said something like, yeah, I don't know. It just came to me. I used to be able to do things.
Yeah, I don't think
I said. He says, I can't anymore.
Yeah.
But I used to be able to.
Right. But I did it, and it's there, and it fucking holds up, you know.
I mean, my thought about it is like, never mind even defending or trying to prove Dylan's greatness. It's like Winston Churchill won a Nobel Prize for literature, so clearly anybody can.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so clearly anybody.
Was that for one of his speeches or one of his books?
For, I think for his like six-volume history of World War II, which I once tried to read and didn't get very far.
Yeah.
You know, this
I'd
rather read a history of World War II where they had like 3 or 4 quotes from this 2,000 pages, and that would be all I would need.
Right, exactly. Tell you, lift a few. Yeah.
So who were your other influences or heroes back then?
Earlier, well, you know, I kind of got interested in poetry. Then the Liverpool scene around 65 came out. Adrian Henry, Roger McGough, and these guys were just writing poems that seemed like everyday stuff. It wasn't like poetry, you know, mm-hmm. like the Poetry Society was pushing. And I don't know, that kind of interest. I think it was really Dylan was a big trigger And
where in England did you grow up?
In the Midlands.
In the Midlands,
okay. Yeah. So I was always reading and writing, but you know, I grew up in this kind of family with no books in a house, and I was the youngest of like 12 kids.
Oh, wow.
So the six of them had already gone by the time I arrived, but it was always a madhouse, you know, with dogs and cats, and we had a pet crow and stuff.
Are they still around? Or?
Some of my siblings are, yeah, but like my brother calls me from England, and he's like, and then there were five. Because, yeah, a dark sense of humor. But, yeah, so everybody's, you know, getting up there now. Mm-hmm. But
did any of them go into the arts or?
No.
No.
No, I was the only one. And that was the thing, you know, that working class thing of, like, if you're reading a book, oh, you know, bloody, look at the bloody bookworm there, because right. You're reading a book, or if you use a word of more than two syllables, oh, what did you have for breakfast, a dictionary?
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's all, you know, I've come to realize over a long period of time, it's all meant to just keep the fucking workers down, keep the people down. And I was lucky because just when I was, 16, 17, they were giving out grants to go to college and stuff, and the bigger the grant, the lower the family income, the larger the grant. Mm-hmm. So I applied for college in secret because my mother, I was the last one, and she didn't want me to go anywhere. And there was a lot of work at the time on building these power stations, you know, mm-hmm. which I worked on in the summer after school, you know, pouring concrete and shit. And anyway, I applied and I got into this college in London. So I had to tell my mother, like in August, that in September I was going to live in London.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing was, the great thing about it was I got this huge grant. So I was like 17 years old. I had a bank account with money in it and
so
go to live in London.
Free tuition and a stipend and able to afford an apartment and all
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, actually, there was this, the first year there was this good school friend of mine who'd gone to London a year earlier to business school and stuff. So we connected up, and then when I went, I went with him, and we shared a bed sit, and then a flat and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's the same thing here, man. Today it's just like, you know, Bernie Sanders is saying free college, and he doesn't mean free college. He means free tuition at state universities if you maintain a certain average. That's right.
Yeah.
But people would still have to pay their room and board and for books and all that. And the Republicans, meanwhile, I just saw a poll, 52% of Republicans think college is bad. Not free college. They think college is bad.
Education is bad.
The professors are all communists and they'll turn into lesbians or whatever, you know.
No, I see they're pushing that like that.
They want people to be ignorant, you know.
Yeah. Well, it works much better for them when they're ignorant. Yeah. That's for sure. No, it's scary. No, that was, for me, that was a fantastic stroke of luck, because otherwise I would have stayed in that small town, probably gotten somebody pregnant, like a lot of my friends are doing. Then back then, if you got somebody pregnant, you usually married them, even if you hardly fucking knew each other, you know? And so I escaped from that, you know. I mean, escaped from it. I liked my life there, and we had pretty wild times in small towns, actually. it was really fun. But I really felt lucky to, you know, have that hatchway and get out, you know. But even though in London, I just didn't take to London at all. I kind of didn't have a very good time there, and I started taking drugs as well, since, you know, they were the kind of acid express was coming down the line. You couldn't really dodge it unless you were, you know, totally like a good student or something. I guess you could dodge it. I don't know. I couldn't dodge
students.
It. I was happy to jump on it. I mean, I was just interested in you know, the total derangement of the senses from an early age. I mean, I just was. I don't know why. I mean, nobody in my family was heavy drinkers or certainly didn't do any drugs, you know. But I was just always fascinated by it. And, you know, one of the earliest influences was Naked Lunch, William Burroughs. But, and even though it didn't encourage me to take drugs, but it had a lot of drug stuff in it. But also there were those anthologies, probably from Grove or something, like hash, hemp, and hallucinogens and things like that, you know, like compilations of drugs. And I just, this sounds really interesting, you know. So I was kind of...
What was the Brian Jison book, the Hashish Journal or something like
that?
Yeah, stuff like that.
There was a lot of stuff around in the late 60s. Because everybody, you know, I mean, when I first went to London, everybody was smoking this really powerful Afghani hash. It's black stuff with that white striations on it, you know. It was.
I had that once in my life. When I was in high school, someone gave me that black Afghani hash with like the pinstripes, which I think was opium.
I think that was the opium leaking out.
I was in high school and I came home and like I walked past my mother and she said, and I said, Mom, I'm going to bed. Like I couldn't hear anything. So fucked up.
No, but that stuff was okay. I used to really have a lot of fun on that. But then when we got to the acid, British acid, which was really. Whatever, I don't know what they put in it, but it wasn't good. And I had the first trip I ever took was a complete disaster. After which, the day after it happened, with a bunch of people too, and no music in this basement in Kentish Town, it was just a setup for craziness. After it happened, I was really like hammered. I went back to my flat, took all my notebooks, and burned everything. So I'm just like paranoia just began. Right then, and I'm so pissed at that still, only because I used to be very unself-conscious about writing down what happened, you know, graphic or just banal, or so it was like it wasn't like it had any literary value, but I had been just doing this right, and then after that, I still kept a journal, but it'd be like hunching over, and you know, you don't want anybody to read it, and just become totally self-conscious about your work. And it's funny, I refer back to that, and you think, oh, you just took it, you had a bad acid trip, you know, you're going to have a good acid trip. But that one was really, it had a much deeper effect on me than I realized, you know, and I still feel it, you know.
And then you have to wonder, so was that really a bad acid trip? Or maybe that was the exact acid trip that you needed.
No, that definitely wasn't. That one wasn't, because it sent me, you know, I was unself-conscious about wanting to write and stuff. Before it, afterwards, I was completely self-conscious and feeling like, oh, this is shit. I don't want to show this to anybody. So it just kind of closed me down for a long time, you know. So... But, no, I still, you know, still did quite a large number of trips after that, because everybody kept saying, well, you know, you had a bad one, but it's really great when you have a good one. All right, well, let's try it again. But it was never anything as terrifying as that one. But it was, you know, and there were some good ones, but still. I mean,
there was definitely, and this is not from personal experience, mind you, but there was there's a big difference between when you got some shitty acid or when you got some really well-made, freshly made
Owsley
stuff
or something.
You know,
right?
From San Francisco, it was a very different drug. But I took some Red Dragon acid in 1979 and went to a Grateful Dead show, and
Listen to these two old geezers talking.
It's like,
if anyone's listening to this, we don't have your eyes.
1979, I know. And I was, and like 24 hours later, I was just like smoking pot, going like, I wonder when I'm going to come down from that.
And
I'm still waiting, basically, to come down.
Right,
I
know. All in all, I mean, I think that first trip, I kind of wonder what would have happened, what the trajectory would have been if I hadn't taken that.
You could have been a doctor or a lawyer.
A diarist.
President.
I could have been a diarist. I don't know. Anyway, but life was much better in New York than London when I came here. And it's continued to be so, you know. I mean, I don't know. I've just been sort of making my way, writing, not getting much published. Small press people like you, very helpful, but I don't know. But it feels, you know, I'm happy with the work I'm doing now. I actually like what I write, so for the most part, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm doing this new project, which you see on the wall, which is just, my wife encouraged me to just start, or she said, I want you to write a new, you know, you need a new book of poetry. So mm-hmm. print some out, and I'll sew them on this canvas, and then you can give the canvas to various artists and ask them to embellish it in whatever way they want, you know. And that way it makes me produce pages, but actually all the work so far is from this one big tract of work that I had from like 2007, which I had generated, but I never edited or anything. So I had like 50,000 words, which I felt like there was some good stuff in there. So it's like diving into it and trying to, you know, mine it for...
So this is different than your book Slow Dazzle, which I guess was just pieces, various pieces from over many years that you matched to different artists.
Yeah, and but those pieces also were more worked and thought out. You know, this was just like, it was this exercise I was doing, which I still try to do sometimes, of like, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day. Okay, that's like about 4 pages, right? Typewritten or, you know, computer written. And so I did that and ended up with like 50,000 words. You know, right. I managed to keep it going, because the thing is, after a certain point, if you can manage to lose that self-consciousness about, oh, I'm writing, I'm now writing, you know, then you kind of, stuff starts to emerge, you
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, I had a similar experience. I did that a few years ago. I just was like, I was working on a book that I'd been working on for years, and I was just struggling with it, and I wasn't feeling it, and then I'm going to do something else. I don't even know what it's going to be, but I'm just going to go down to my office and do 500 words a day.
Yeah.
Maybe 1,000. We'll see. And in like a month, I had the first draft of a novel. You know,
it couldn't work like that. I mean, it didn't work like that for me in terms of a narrative thing, because I know reading through some of this, that's why there's a lot of redaction on it, you know, in that version. So then it gets redacted, and then I'll do the kind of redacted version or the edited version afterwards, and hopefully it'll get shaved down into acceptable.
It's the same thing. I wrote this novel in 30 days and then spent 3 years, you know, on
trying to make
it into something, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's
but
tough.
I couldn't recommend that more for anybody who wants to write.
No,
just write every day, write 1,000 words every day.
Write every day. And 1,000 words is kind of, because when I say to people 1,000 words, they're like, well, 1,000 words. It's like, I don't mean.
1,000 words is a little tough sometimes, but that's
what I don't mean 1,000 words, polished words.
Right.
It's like 1,000 words, because I know in some of things, like, I do a word count, like, oh my God, 400 words to go. Well, you can't use that in the fucking thing in the count.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I was doing this, I was just like, it's like, I'm not waiting for inspiration. It's 9 o'clock.
Yeah, no, you can't.
It's 9 o'clock. I'm going to go start typing and see what happens. And you end up throwing away, you know.
But the inspiration, I think, or the muse, or whatever you want to call it. I was reading this guy's book, The War of Art. Do you know that book by this guy, Stephen Satterfield? It's just really, really practical advice to get to work, to stop procrastinating, which is my main.
Well, it's the easy. I heard someone say it's the easiest thing in the world is not writing.
Yeah, but he was talking about saying the muse, and the muse, he believes the muse does visit. He said, but the muse tends to come once you started working, sees you working, and then gives you a hand with it. Yeah, but it's not going to come up while you're sitting there smoking your opium, waiting for the muse to start.
Yeah, the muse goes
start doing your job for you.
I'm not stopping with that guy. That guy's not doing anything.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but look at that guy. He's really trying. We'll go and give him a little nudge.
Yeah, you know. That's exactly it.
So, what else? I don't know. What else I'm talking about? Who were my influences? I said the Mersey. I'm trying to think of English poets.
Well, how about who are you reading these days? What's what are you?
I'm reading actually all the. You know, I feel like the state of poetry or New York poetry. I don't know if it's statewide, worldwide. It's gotten very much into identity poetry. You know, rather than like just good poetry.
Well, that's been for a long time.
Yeah, right? I guess for a long time. I mean,
it's
I got
kind of like the New Yorkian thing, I think.
Yeah, and I got kicked to the curb by the St. Mark's crowd as well. Even
really?
Yeah, I couldn't even get into the, the annual New Year's Day reading.
I saw someone else whose name I'm not going to mention was saying on Facebook that I didn't get invited to St. Mark's for the first time in 25 years.
I know.
And then I looked at the list of people.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, again,
names, I know, and that's just all that
don't belong.
But you know, it's always that this poetry scene in New York has always been this sort of backstabbing kind of thing. I've never felt really a huge part of it. And of course, you know, I did that Gap ad back in 1992,
right.
The TV ad that,
right.
You know, just got nothing but scorn from my
downtown
fellows,
of
whom would have killed to fucking do it themselves.
That's right, of course.
You know,
and I
but anyway, that, yeah, that
that's
kind
when
of,
I first heard of you, I think, was when you did that.
Yeah.
Like,
that asshole
who
did the Gap ad, right?
You know, what the fuck, man? I was
no, and somebody, I remember somebody said, why would Max Planck do a Gap ad? And I was thinking like, what, you know, why not for 2 years rent or something?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean,
getting paid for poetry is a crime.
Yeah, and it wasn't even that terrible a poem either. It really wasn't.
It was, wait a minute, I remember what it was. It was My Blue Jeans, something
like
that.
Yeah, it mentioned Blue Jeans, but it didn't mention a name of the company.
My Blue Jeans is a Ted Jones poem. Wait a minute.
Is it? Well, maybe I got it from Ted.
Maybe he stole it and didn't even know. Even better.
But you know, then the funny thing was after that, Madonna came along and used two lines from that Gap poem, and I had to try and negotiate with her, which was pretty hopeless. I got some money from her, but very little, because as it turned out, I didn't know at the time, but she had already written and recorded the song that she used the lines in. So if I'd have held out, she would have had to give me like songwriting credit, because it used more than like, how, I don't know what the thing is. It was the title and two lines.
You know, I think there's they call it change a word, get a third. It's just like all the pop songs nowadays are written by like three guys.
Yeah.
One of them's name is called Max Martin. He writes all the songs for like Beyonce and Katy Perry and Taylor Swift. There's like three guys and they write all the songs, and then they take the songs that they've written and they change two, three words, and they get a third of the royalties. So they call it change a word, get a third. So
really?
Yeah. So if you actually had some phrases in there, they could have
No, because, you know, and I'm still a little bitter at Madonna, because she could have easily thrown that bone to me, you know, but she didn't. You know, she was really hard-ass about negotiation. I got like $20,000 or something, flat fee, which, you know, of course, I didn't have any money, so $20,000 was like a fucking fortune.
Right.
But I figured out, even if I only got paid a penny an album, I would have made like $300,000, because it was the Ray of Light album that sold like 11 million copies. It's still selling, I guess. Anyway, let's not be bitter about our inability to earn a crust from poetry.
But yeah, no, I remember. You know Emily XYZ, right?
Yeah.
And she did a Nike commercial, I think.
Oh, yeah?
And
around the same time,
maybe a little later, whatever. And again, there was...
No, because Burroughs did a Nike commercial, too. Right after...
Did it really?
Yeah. Right after people said, what are you doing a fucking Gap ad for? You know, and I said, well, William Burroughs did a Nike, folks. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, why not?
Anyway.
Why not? Whatever you can do.
Yeah. No, but somebody said, you know, the reason there's so much backstabbing among poets and stuff is that there's so little that gets given out to poets.
Well, exactly. I mean, the way I've heard it.
And most of that goes to Eileen Miles, it seems.
Uh-huh. Well, the way I heard it, not even in reference to poetry, but I immediately thought of the poetry scene. There's somebody who's talking about academia, and someone was saying that no matter what field you're in, the smaller the stakes, the worse the politics.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what they're saying. That's why in academia, people don't get paid that much, so the politics are... And I was like, oh, wow, what about the poetry scene where the stakes are tiny?
The stakes are not...
Who's
there
gonna
are
get
no
a piece,
stakes.
Who's going to get a piece in some
the
little
magazine
that
The only stakes are the
one
that Ron
for.
Colm is impaled upon for his insistence on my participation in the
unbearable. Hey, Ron.
Ron needs you to, you needed to class the judge.
I needed to castigate Ron for a second. He's throwing a party for you tomorrow, did you know?
I did, I heard.
Because I checked and I said, is it a surprise party?
Yeah.
And he said, no. So I can say that. But yeah, I'm coming over to that.
Oh, okay, good.
Is there going to be a reading though as well?
I think there's a, so if everybody wants to mark the date, this will have happened 4 to 6 weeks before you hear this.
If you want to come to his party.
Get in your time machine late. And send me a fax and I'll send you the address. There's a open mic at 4 and then the party starts at 6:30. So I don't know if I'm going to make it to the open mic or not.
Don't you think open mics should be kind of banned for a while?
Oh, now
should we have a moratorium?
Now we're getting into some some dangerous territory. Yeah. I mean, no, I would say no.
No, I would say no.
Open mics are, it's good for people to go out and whatever.
But the problem I've always had with poetry readings, and I feel it's one reason why they're less well attended than they could easily be, is that people, especially at group readings, if it's not just one person reading, or two people even, any more than two, people get up there and they do not get off the stage once they started.
Yeah.
I mean, I call it mic fever. We always used to call it mic fever, where people just, they get a few laughs, so they think, you see a sheaf of papers like an inch thick. I just think it's just very inconsiderate to the other performers and to the audience,
I agree. First of all, so as far as open mics, I think open mics are great. It's great for people who are just starting out to go and...
That's true. I was
goofing. Should you go to an open mic? No, probably not. Probably not.
They're good.
As far as
Let me know how it was.
As far as like the people... I've seen that happen so many times. Somebody reads for 5-10 minutes, they get a laugh, and they go, okay, let me give you another one. It's like, no, stop.
Yeah.
It's the first rule of show business is you leave them begging for more.
Right.
You don't give them more than they want.
No, and that's the funny thing with me, because I always really like poetry readings. God knows why. You know, people make fun of you for it. Oh, there's a poetry reading. You want to go? And they just look at you like, no, why?
Yeah.
No. But I just like going, you know, especially if it's somebody whose work I already know and like.
Right.
But you go to these other things, and then somebody gets up there and just bewails the shit out of the microphone for 25 minutes, and he's just like, why?
Well, you know,
I guess it's never going to change. So did it myself, as I'm proud of in my own.
Yeah. When I've done the sensitive skin readings, I've been like, you know, I'm like Mussolini, you know, I say, and I've done some with more credit. I say, 5 minutes, you got 5 minutes. If you go for 10 minutes, I'm never going to invite you to one of these things again.
Right. Yeah. No, I know the last one you did at Bower that I was at was good, because it was just like boom, boom, up, down. Right. And it was, you know, and then people get a taste of everything. You don't get...
And that worked. And I was very strict. Or else we did one together another time where I had three people. And I was like, 20 minutes, poetry readings... 15
but
minutes,
I'm telling you, any reading, any audience cannot, I think there's even a scientific fact about it, that the brain can only, it doesn't matter how great it is, unless maybe it's, you know, the end of Ulysses, you know, read by one of those beautiful Irish women. But apart from that, the brain can only really absorb about 45 minutes before you kind of, even 45 minutes.
That's way too much. I've said to people, it's like, listen, nobody wants to hear anybody for more than 15 minutes, unless you're William Burroughs or Charles Bukowski, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, you can go longer than that. So less is more, for sure. But it is fun to go to poetry readings, because, first of all, there's the social thing. You get to see people. And it's also, poetry is meant to be heard, right? Which is why we're doing this thing. I'm going to ask you to read some of your work. So,
okay.
Do you want to... let's see. Yeah, it's about time. You wanna read something?
Yeah, I'll read. What I'll read is something from this, you know, which is, since it's the most recent publication, it's called Walkabout NYC, with
photos of old Soho from 73 that I took myself when I was here, first year. And this is just kind of a poem about just walking through New York and just, you know, your memory being triggered by various things, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. You walk past the building, you remember someone who lived there or something happened there or something like that. But, yeah, this started with a collaboration I did with this photographer artist named Barney Kulak, and he had done this done these beautiful information paintings, he called them, where he went walking around, but he had his phone, and he was collecting the Wi-Fi names, because I guess when you go into one area, you get a list of Wi-Fi names,
right,
you know.
Right.
So he was, and then he constructed these beautiful word paintings from them, and so I wanted to do something with him, and actually Aperture magazine asked me to write something about a photographer. So we were just doing this thing at the time, so I said, oh, Barney, we'll do this, you know. But I wasn't sure what to write. I don't like to write sort of critical writing anyway. And is this intro taking too long?
No.
No. And so I decided to just follow his route. He had taken three walks. So I decided to do the same three walks and just generate, see what was generated for me, you know, nothing. But what I did to reference the Wi-Fi names was I made up my own Wi-Fi names that occur as breaks in this text as a sort of like a coffee break, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just have these, and it's just kind of a ranting kind of Wi-Fi thing. But the nice thing about doing this was I started doing it. I was very tentative. I didn't know what was going to happen. I actually had a little tape recorder with me, which I ended up not using at all. But once I started doing it, I really kind of got, things seemed to present themselves to me that were worthy of recording, you know, recording in mentally and on paper and stuff. But then when I did the second one, it was even, just things kept happening. Like one thing that happened were these girl, I was walking along Greenwich Street, which was pretty deserted, and there were these three girls playing hooky, smoking cigarettes, and one of them was the daughter of a friend of mine, you know, who's, and she came, oh, Max, what are you doing here? I said, I'm putting you in this poem. But it was just kind of like, you know, there were just these little things, you felt like you were generating something, you know, mm-hmm. by looking, you would find something. I don't know, but anyway, it was a really cool exercise, you know, and it kind of, it's a good thing to read aloud, I think.
Okay.
So let's do that. It's called Walkabout NYC. Starting from Center Place at Grand Street, the gun sign Ouija photographed is long gone, along with the firearms dealers it once announced. On this side street of Manhattan, a man landed on the spikes of the railings around police headquarters, tossed out a high window by drunken cops. It didn't even make the front page. Back then, they could hose you down with impunity. Now, at least, we get some of it on film. Those cops are gone to cemeteries in Queens, the railings melted down for artillery shells. Supermodels live there now. And across the street, looking north, 400 Broom is a college dorm. In a previous life, the building was an evidence locker, cluttered with drugs and weapons, the tag on a blood-stained hammer describing in clinical detail the end of a life. Massive quantities of confiscated dope from the French Connection case were replaced with sugar and cornstarch. The theft was only discovered because insects were forming long lines to feed on the switched bait, by which time half the city was on the nod. Who lives here now? Purple Haze, Jezebel, Luigi, Extreme Pubic, Temple Fong, Two Guys and a Switchblade, Kiki of Broom Street, Mango Mama, Mandalay, Haiku Stew, Another Green World, Free Fish, Little Mouse, Mustache, Scratches, Moribund, Muscle Hound, Star 80, El Bordello, Brass Eye, Jackie Ho. Those are the Wi-Fi names. You're welcome to use any of them, by the way. Each intersection a gathering point for memory. Criminals were hanged and buried at crossroads so their bodiless souls would not know which road to take. Lives in cities are lost in so many ways. Slapped down by buses and cabs, sliced by knives, stabbed by daggers, split by axes, crushed by elevators. jab with ice pick and contaminated needle. Even lightning bears down. That boy on a Soho rooftop cavorting in a summer storm unwittingly called down the Lord of Thunder and electric light concealed in a passing cloud. Thor iced him in mid-step with a single bolt to the head. Men struck by lightning outnumber women by 70%. It's the iron in their blood, testosterone calling down ionic surge of heat and light, a terrible bang and your shoes explode as the electricity emerges from your tailpipe, having fried your insides on its furious passage through your mortal frame, your final sip of tequila still buzzing in the thorax and gone again, back to matter or no matter, drawn up to heaven on a bolt of light, an electric hook. Walk on past Spring Street, where I first landed in this mad metropolis, and in the absence of a doorbell, yelled up at the window of number 118. Caroline topless threw the keys down in a sock. Thank you, Caroline. Thank you, Iggy, the Villarreals, who hardly knew me, took me in and fed me, a delightful pair who never wore clothes around the house, and sent Jerry at the Senegian Company Bar and Grill, who hired me to wash dishes. Promoted me to busboy after I helped out in a fistfight. I finally made it to waiter and spent much of my time running down Broadway after people who'd walked out on their checks. The place closed down finally after too many indoor rainstorms, and shortly afterward the building itself, the Broadway Central Hotel, tumbled into the street, fell by the weight of its own karma. People were always very kind. Tom Birdie got me a job steel fixing at LaGuardia, an immigrant watching the planes arrive as I twisted wire around the rebar. For 3 months, I was a union man. Paul Pines, with his tiny house full of books on the roof of 57 Second Avenue, let me stay there alone for weeks, on top of the world, Lower East Side humming and snarling far below. Steve Shevlin, who fixed my gas heater in that slum on 10th and C, where the junkies enter by their fire escape on alternate nights to pick up the leftovers from their previous nocturnal visits. Who lives here now? Tarantella, Marcello, Pecca Heater, Wife Beater, Lion Tooth, Midwife, Sightseer, Grenadier, Billy Joe, Rambo, Barfly, Bowl Feeder, Monthly Bleeder, Paycheck and Coat Check and Joystick, Spike Splitter, Day Tripper, Shunter, Topon, Own Goal, Gazelle Smeller, Dry Diver, Crackwise, Shoe Size, Brain Fry, Nice Guy. How much of this would you like?
You can keep going. Right. A couple more minutes.
Walk on. June 3rd, 1968, guns and gunshots in Union Square. Valerie Solanas, bright-eyed and crazy in her plaid newsboy hat, crossed the park and sat on a bench, reread her manifesto for cutting up men, then went up to the sixth floor of 33 Union Square West with a 22 pistol in a brown paper bag. She put two slugs into Andy Warhol's torso. A visiting art critic got shot in the butt as he fled this performance piece. And did Fred Hughes mess his custom-tailored pants when Valerie held the gun to his head? Wouldn't you? I peed my pants when chased by skinheads in London once. It took me years to admit that, terrified, I had bolted like a rabbit. They didn't catch me in Charing Cross, and Fred was spared in Union Square when Valerie's pistol jammed. Andy survived, maimed for life. Later, Larry Rivers filmed the scars for his movie Tits, a seedy exploitation of the breast that played for months at the Bleecker Street Cinema. An Avedon photographed Andy's chest looking like the surface of the moon. Alice Neal made a more tender portrait, and Lou Reed wrote a poem about Andy's wounds that was published in the Paris Review. Valerie went to jail and never retrieved the play that made her gun crazy in the first place. Its titillating title was Up Your Ass. Andy had promised to make it into a film. Who lives here now? Gun-shy, jippy-jappy, French letter, digger may, moral tissue, upskirt, Bergdorf, toy boy, draculator, common one, turkey baster, tarantalula, eyewash, slapper cracker, bung sniff, peck sniff, jaundice and jaundice. Light floods over the low buildings of the square from all directions, illuminating the sanitized park where old Methodonians used to gather on damaged benches, nuked by their meds. Memories of high-grade heroin crawling through their blood like snakes. Skateboarders hit it now. The crack of custom boards giving innocent citizens whiplash. At 17th Street, four cop cars equals 100 well-dunked donuts. In the green market, the dirt on the rutabagas and the celeriac was a murky black, as if they'd been cultivated in industrial waste. Ruddy-cheeked farmers must be compelled to explain why their spuds cost $2 a pound. Market prices adjusted to snare the yupsters sweeping through Whole Foods, waving credit cards sharp as knives. It's our New York now, abuelo, they snarl when some grizzled hipster starts up about the old days, how we were here before the flood, dancing in lofts as big as stadiums, cracking heads on Chambers Street, lying down with dogs in Chinatown, running rings around the midnight sun. The light is sharp as a butcher's blade in Union Square today, Prussian blue like an Austrian's eyes, or an Eve Klein, no relation to Klein's on the square, where Ted Berrigan and Joe Brainard fondle soft sweaters and plump, rumpled skirts on their way to poetry. Both those poets gone too soon, one from narcotic tribulations and the other taken by the plague that swept through our beautiful youth through the 80s and beyond, a wound that does not close. At the foot of Park Avenue, fake limos unload undernourished models outside another boutique hotel, a step away from where Max's Kansas City once punched holes in the night. The serious artists in drunken intellectual clumps up front, making plans to extract oil money from the Schlumberger's Deer Foundation that gave so much to so few. Jackie Curtis and René Ricard shrieking in the back room, dispensing pass and fail cards to the hip and the lame. And Candy says, I've come to hate my body and all that it requires. Who lives here now? Calf Cat, Slim Jim, Alleluia, Brimstone, Fake Money, Jockstrip, Infuse, Fat Freeze, Panty Handler, Firehole, Reckless Eyeball, Weak Knee, Knuckle Bucket, Nipple Tweak, Winkle Picker, Apple Cider, Typhoid Mary, Holy Moses, Random Fairy, Shindig, Meat Puppet, Tinsel, and Gretel. That was the first one.
That's great.
Oh, thank you.
I loved it.
That's available from Shallow Books. It's a very nice little
It is a very
production.
Beautiful book. Yep. Do I get a copy?
You don't have one?
No.
Oh, yeah, of course you can.
Yeah, all right.
And anyone else out there in that great blue ether who needs a copy of Walkabout by the Black.
You got to buy one.
Do another.
All right, Max.
How much time you got?
What?
How much time we gave?
About an hour.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. I hope that works. I felt like there was one point when we were doing the talking about drugs, I was like, oh, fuck, shut up. You know, I've mused on that
no
too
drug.
Often.
We were just hypothetical. It was all hypothetical.
Yeah.
Drugs.
No, I'm not worried about that. I mean, I do. Okay, and all you get from that is a bunch of people then share about their own fucking acid trips. Can be
the only thing.
It's like
more
people telling you your dreams.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's, oh man,
I know.
It's like the scariest words
really?
In the English language. I had the wildest dream last night.
Really? Do tell.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, you're welcome, man.